I believe we are approaching the end of the Empire, and what it means for the Deep State is that the Deep State needs to be brought into the light. I think that the democratizing the U.S. and making it transparent is actually in the interest of these people, but will they ever accept it? And that is the big question. I would hope that there are some disclosures coming. Maybe things like Tucker Carlson's 9/11 documentary are a good sign that we're going to be headed in that kind of a direction, and that they're trying to roll it out in weird ways. I don't know. This is the strangest time to be alive.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. You know, a lot is made of the so-called deep state. A lot of people, especially on the left, think that the deep state is just a right-wing trope to complain about government. I can tell you, coming from the left, that the deep state is absolutely real. It's real and it's ugly, and I know because I was a part of it when I spent 15 years at the CIA, and frankly, another couple of years on Capitol Hill on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff. Listen, you don't have to call it the deep state. You can call it whatever you want. You can call it the state. You can call it the federal bureaucracy. But the truth of the matter is that it is there. It's there to stay. It's not going anywhere. Well, we're going to talk about this with Dr. Aaron Good. He's one of the country's leading experts on the assassinations of prominent political leaders, on the deep state, and on the role of the CIA in subterfuge around the world. The reason why we're talking about him today, or talking with him today specifically, is that his outstanding book, American Exception, Empire and the Deep State, is being made into a three-part documentary miniseries. Aaron, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hey, thank you, John. It's great to have you. It's good to be with you again. I was going to interview you, and then we switched it around, so I got to adjust to being the interview subject, but thank you for the introduction.
Oh, I appreciate it. You really are one of the country's leading experts on the deep state. And we're talking about everything from the Kennedy assassinations, Martin Luther King, the CIA, the overthrow of governments. Tell us about the origins of the deep state and how it happened right under the nose of the American people without anybody really paying much attention.
Well, the U.S. has never been fully a democracy. It's always been an oligarchy, going back to before the War for Independence. There was always an oligarchy of private wealth, and the U.S. was always a capitalist nation, whose politics was dominated by wealthy individuals, an oligarchy. Now, without rehashing all of U.S. history, if we go to World War II, the U.S., the U.S. establishment made the decision to go for hegemony over capitalism, over global capitalism, and to be the leader of the free world was how they presented it. And in order to do that, they were going to have to create a new kind of regime, a new kind of political regime. And a political regime, the word regime is a key here, because in political science, it doesn't mean just the state or the government. It means all those institutions which determine who has access to control of the state, who is able to control the state. And we are told that we have a democratic state with, you know, laws and transparent government and elections and so on. But it's much more top down than that in practice. And when you find out how top down it is, when an elected official tries to move the policy of the U.S. in a way that the oligarchy doesn't want. And since the elite of America, the wealthiest people, decided that they wanted global empire, you know, a dollarized system that the U.S. would dominate and police globally after World War II, the oligarchy wanted this, and John Kennedy attempted to change this by calling for an end to the Cold War, among other policies that he had that upset the establishment at the time and the established powers. And so we get this apparatus, this set of, in this network, institutions, parties, organizations that affect the assassination of President Kennedy. And there we see something that can't really be described by reference to democratic or liberal understandings of how the government works. And that's why it gets denied up to this day, even though pretty much anyone who looks at these things objectively realizes that the regime, in the biggest sense, killed JFK. So the deep state is top-down governance in a nominal democracy. It's not like you needed a deep state exactly. I mean, you probably had some kind of power structure behind the scene. You certainly did in Nazi Germany, but you didn't quite have the deep state in the same way because you had the Führer principle, and it was known that whatever the Führer had to do in this emergency was acceptable because it was protecting the state against existential threats. That's the idea. The deep state operates similarly, saying with the logic that everything it does is for the preservation of the state. However, it is not allowed to say that it is the Führer. It is not allowed to say we can kill anyone we want, anytime, anywhere. And so it uses covert operations, as like you were a part of when you were in the clandestine service. And this gives rise to a different form of governance where you really can't change policies by elections. And it goes beyond just the bureaucracies. You're talking about oligarchic control over media and political parties and manipulation of the culture in ways that we probably don't even have any clue of. It's a system of top-down governance in a nominal democracy. That's what the deep state is. And it's bent on empire and U.S. global dominance, especially in the 21st century. And it's so imperialistic and irrational in many ways that it's brought the era, centuries of Western imperialism to the brink of destruction, which is probably a good thing for human history, for this era of white Western people just telling the rest of the world how it's going to be. It probably needs to come to an end. But because the deep state essentially it's a very dark kind of lawless milieu of people who are going to control the foreign policy apparatus and the right to kill people with impunity and so on. Well, it got taken over by very ruthless people in a sense. And I think that this is tied to the Zionism and the neoconservative push for global dominance. And Zionism has been a big part of that. And so that's why the deep state in the 21st century has a very Zionist flavor to it. And I think that that has brought us to the disaster that we're experiencing now.
So tell us a little bit about the differences between the deep state of the 1950s and 60s. Think the Dulles brothers, the Kennedy assassination, versus the deep state that we see today, where you've got secret prisons, you've got a torture program, you've got renditions.
Okay. The deep state, I believe, in the 50s, And originally, as it was conceived at the Council on Foreign Relations, the U.S. Empire was conceived, the Council on Foreign Relations was doing this State Department study called the War and Peace Studies Project, and it was going to plan the U.S. Response to World War II and then what they would do afterwards to win the peace. And this was a WASPier sort of Eastern establishment, corporate power, old money, power formation in the U.S. more or less at this time. And it was centered around Standard Oil, especially was the biggest force behind Eisenhower. So Rockefellers would be a part of this. They ran the Council on Foreign Relations. Henry Kissinger was a Rockefeller man. Eisenhower came to the White House on a tidal wave of Standard Oil cash. And so back then it had a slightly, in the 50s, it had a slightly different cast to it. Because of this, Rockefeller and Eisenhower, they were not really neocons and they weren't super Zionists in the way that other presidents would be. And the way that you can see this most clearly is how in 1956, when the Israelis tried another land grab with the Suez Crisis, and they were backed by the British and the French in this, the Eisenhower opposed it and put a stop to it. And that really marked the end of the British Empire and the British Empire's attempt to tie its fortunes to an aggressive sort of Zionism that would get them the Suez Canal back and so on. So you see there a battle line or a cleavage in the U.S. establishment that some people wanted Israel to be able to do this, but Eisenhower, the president, didn't want them to be able to do this. And JFK also approaches Israel he wants them to not interfere with what he thinks would be a better policy, which is for the U.S. to have good relations with people like Nasser and to solve the Palestinian refugee crisis and to stop nuclear weapons from proliferating in the Middle East, because Israel was pursuing the bomb and JFK was completely opposed to that. So they get rid of JFK. And I believe that ultimately this had to have been sanctioned by the apex of the military intelligence apparatus. However, I believe they had to rely on Zionist assets, essentially, and things connected to the syndicate, the National Crime Syndicate, which was, because of Meyer Lansky, essentially an Israeli asset. The National Crime Syndicate was an Israeli asset functionally during these decades. Meyer Lansky was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1945. He established a big drug connection in Mexico the same year with this guy named Harold Meltzer. And this was to deal with the fact that drug trafficking routes had been disrupted by the war. He establishes the city of Las Vegas. I think this is in like 1946. And he has his guy, Bugsy Siegel, running it. Also, Bugsy Siegel.
He hated to be called Bugsy.
Yeah, that's right.
He liked to be called Benny.
Yeah.
You don't want to call him Bugsy to his face.
He had a temper, supposedly. It's made him a good assassin for a time. And so this is a key event in the formation of the deep state, because it's not just government bureaucracies, it's the fix. It's the fix for the National Crime Syndicate. And what it did was, because the drug traffickers have to corrupt law enforcement to be able to function, right? It's really having the fix is what guarantees you, it makes it very likely that you're going to be successful and you'll make a lot of money. It's not because you're the best businessman. It's because you have the fix with the law enforcement. And for the National Crime Syndicate, they had the fix on a national level with J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, as well as the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger. And James Angleton in counterintelligence was also going to protect Lansky from being investigated. And the only administration that attempted really to investigate Vegas and the casinos and all this, is the reason that Vegas is founded is to launder drug money. That was the reason it was set up in the first place. And the syndicate gets control of the Teamsters and their pension funds. And they make loans to Las Vegas. They build up the strip. It attracts a whole lot of people to come and gamble and see all the crazy shows they have there. But I've come to think it's like a mirage or an illusion in the desert. And that what's really going on is massive amounts of drug money laundering. And that's a big part of what makes these casinos very profitable, because it's the perfect business with which to launder money, because it has massive amounts of cash going through. People don't want to report it on their income taxes. It's just a way to, that was the reason it was set up in the first place. And I think that this had an effect on the U.S. economy and the structure of the oligarchy in the U.S. because there's so much money in drugs. It's one of the three most lucrative commodities internationally, along with weapons and oil. So here you have a source of liquid capital that gets laundered and, you know, made legitimate in Las Vegas and elsewhere. And then it creates a whole sort of constellation of financial interests and corporate interests in the legitimate economy that are tied to sort of criminal elements and the bigger criminal element is itself tied closely to Israel because of Lansky. Lansky in 1948, along with Jimmy Hoffa of the Teamsters, they worked to funnel arms to the state of Israel. And they did other, you know, they people around Vegas, people like Hank Greenspun, were huge Zionists, and they looked to help the cause of Israel any way that they could. So there was more going on. The syndicate had powerful friends, corrupt politicians, but also the Zionism. The only time they really go after Lansky is under Nixon, and that's sort of building on the RFK investigations that he had begun into Vegas and all of this. And then Meyer Lansky flees to Israel. What happens in the U.S. is basically Watergate. And that there's a change of power. And it seems that what happens with Nixon are connected. Lansky is forced to stay. He stays in Israel, but he goes back in late 1972 after Nixon's lost. But the Watergate burglars are already in jail. And some of the money trail that they have left traces right back to Mexican banks, you know, in that Lansky CIA milieu, because, you know, the CIA and the government worked with Lansky and back in World War II, and people like Angleton continued to work with Lansky in the CIA. So Watergate traced back to this relationship between the security services and the drug trade. And if it was investigated, it would have exposed all of these things. And this is a part of how they're able to get rid of Nixon, is because it just can't be investigated. It would expose too many things. It would discredit the US. So I'm trying to explain how the deep state kind of becomes this relationship with organized crime, creates a foreign policy, imperialist political apex that is where the crime and the criminal elements are too big to fail. The empire is too big to fail. So they can blackmail each other. They can use the leverage on different parties. And this determines political outcomes. Like they can't investigate the Kennedy assassination, even though Jack Ruby is the most suspicious and sinister character you can imagine in terms of what he connects to, a network of tolerated drug traffic that's a part of the U.S. political system, in effect.
So, man, you've led me to so many different questions. I'll start with this one.
I'm sorry. I know that's a lot to say, and it's so different from the way these things are usually discussed. So I'm sorry if that's a crazy answer, but it's all in my mind all the time these days.
Oh, yeah. I'm as fascinated by Meyer Lansky as you are. So I'll ask the shorter question first then. Lansky went to Israel. He did it to avoid prosecution here in the United States. But then Goldemeyer expelled him back to the United States. Why did that happen? And then once Lansky returned, what happened to him? Nixon was gone. Ford was president. And then what?
He's indicted, but he's never convicted of anything serious. And he retires in Florida. And there's this letter that he writes in 1975. I found that it was auctioned somewhere. And I found the letter online. And it said, it's written to his friend back in Israel, I believe. And he's saying, boy, that Nixon, he really thought he could take over, didn't he? So it's like he's saying that he seems to be relating Nixon's, like, what is he saying Nixon tried to take over? I mean, I think he's pointing to the fact that by going after Lansky, they were seeking to either restructure or just destroy the crime syndicate. I don't think they wanted to destroy it. I think they knew it was too ingrained, but they had different, you know, elements of the Teamsters connected to the Republican Party instead of the Democrats. Like, they had a Republican governor in Nevada. You had the whole Howard Hughes debacle, which is connected to this. And the Mormons around him, by the way, and the Mormons seem to be tied to Israel on some level, through Lansky. Like, there seems to be some Zionist neoconservative syndicate connection there. And when you think about Howard Hughes and the Mormon mafia and all that, and then people that were taking Nixon down, part of them, like Jack Anderson, he was a Mormon, and his office mate was Irving Davidson, who was this huge Zionist guy who was connected to Hoffa and who only approached Hoffa and became Hoffa's lawyer and PR man because Israel requested him. At least that's what some FBI documents have stated. Jonathan Marshall cites that in his book. So it's what happens in 72, there seems to be this big conflict over it. And eventually it looks so bad for Israel that I think that they're also sorting things out in the U.S. that by the time they've got this bomb sort of planted for Nixon, I think that they know it's safe to send Lansky back. I think that he sort of takes one for the team and he's willing to risk going to jail. But also people know that the situation in the U.S. is precarious because of the Watergate issue, which is a very strange issue where you have these guys in jail who are with the CIA, but they don't want to just allow the CIA to be blamed for the crime, especially Jim McCord or James McCord. Yeah, James McCord. So I think that he was sent back. He sort of takes one for the team and takes a risk by coming back to the U.S., but it's in the service of Israel to make Israel not look tainted by organized crime. And also, they're likely aware that nothing is going to come of it because they know that Nixon is actually in big trouble and that they have powerful political allies in the U.S. and they have lots of blackmail over the U.S., including the JFK assassination.
So this is more than just the conventional wisdom that Israel's ultimate goal was to acquire a nuclear weapon. It's deeper than that. It's to exert right. influence, maybe even control in aspects of the American government.
Yeah, especially to affect greater Israel and to be able to have this pipe dream come to life of a greater Israel seems to be the obsession. I mean, that's the, when you look back at all of their actions and all the ways that they've always managed to avoid ever having peace with the Palestinians and sabotaging all these peace talks, murdering people that are supposed to do negotiations. I think that this has been the obsession for these elements. There's a reason that Israel has never declared its borders. Let's just say.
That's a good point. Is there a difference, Aaron, between the deep state of that area and the deep state today? And secondarily, is there a difference in the way the Israelis approach the deep state from the era around the founding of the state of Israel and today?
I believe that earlier their position was not as strong, and it took the consolidation of a lot of power and money in the U.S., you know, the forces of capitalism unleashed after World War II allowed corporate power to make a lot of money, and the drug trade, the oligarchs who benefited from it, they became very powerful, and they invested in military companies. They profited from the Vietnam War, just different aspects of U.S. capitalism. I think these elements were able to profit from and become part of integrated into the regular economy. And so this was something that it's their power grew over time. And the people that did, Nixon challenged it. Well, let's look at the people who challenged it. Nixon did challenge it, but before him, JFK challenged the war machine. And it's not merely, I'm not trying to put the entire blame on Zionism specifically. It's alliances with Zionists and military contractors, different people in the oil industry, especially the in the West and Southwest. So not so much Standard Oil, but people like KBR, Bechtel, Halliburton, the things we associate more with the people around Dick Cheney later in later decades, and this sort of the South of the U.S., the Southwest, not so much the Eastern establishment. It changes the structure of the U.S. economy. And so JFK goes against Israel and also the war machine, calling for, you know, nuclear inspections in Israel and for reexamining the Cold War and for withdrawing from Vietnam. And so he gets assassinated. And his brother immediately, or a week later, Robert Kennedy, sends an emissary to Russia to say, hey, we know that you didn't kill Jack. It was a domestic right-wing conspiracy. Lyndon Johnson's too close to big business. He's not going to be a partner for peace. But Robert plans to make a run for the White House, and then we can resume JFK's policies of, you know, peace, essentially. And they obviously assassinate RFK in 1968, and a Palestinian patsy is used in that case, which is interesting. Now, Nixon didn't really take a hard stance against Israel, but he did indirectly by virtue of the going after Lansky, for example. I don't know everything that works out in that era, but something crucial happens in 1973 with the end of Bretton Woods, and then this big shock. So there's the Bretton Woods ends in 1971, which is the U.S. gold-backed dollar system, because of Vietnam War spending. And so for a time they're negotiating, how are we going to have a new system that's more fair, since the U.S. is no longer honoring its obligations to give us gold for the dollars that it spends everywhere. But the U.S. was really stalling in all of these. They weren't sincere about coming up with something more fair. What ends up happening is, while they're in the midst of these negotiations, the war breaks out in the Middle East, and between Egypt and Israel, and I think others are on the side, like Syria's the side of the Yom Kippur War.
Jordan. Yep.
And this leads to a huge spike in oil prices. And this was encouraged by Kissinger. Kissinger went around and told the Shah, I believe it was he told the Shah that they wanted these oil price hikes. And then the Saudi foreign minister asked about, like, was talking about the oil and how they should, if they should raise oil prices. And I believe the response from the Shah was, look, the Americans want this. Henry Kissinger asked us for this. Because by raising oil prices like that, because of the war, you are able to take all those dollars that are in foreign governments and they all go to oil producing countries because people have to buy oil in dollars. And those countries are under the thumb of the U.S. So they're not going to cause them problems. They're going to reinvest them in Western banks and in Western treasuries to fund the U.S. debt. And this is how this new dollar system was created. And Israel was a part of that. They bled for this in 1973 with this war. That was really a war of all U.S. proxies at this point, because Egypt was run by Sadat at this point, who seems to be a CIA asset of some kind. And then Indonesia is an oil producer. Iran is run by a U.S. puppet. The Saudis are U.S. puppet. All of the big oil producers in the world are U.S. puppets. And of course, Israel is close to the U.S. as well. And what does the war really do? It benefits the U.S. enormously. They're the real winner. It's a stalemate over in the Middle East, but the U.S. is the big winner because it saves the dollar system. So I think something in that plays out with the way that Watergate shook out, that Israel actually did something useful, we could say, for the U.S. during that time period by fighting in this war. And the U.S. had been arming the other countries to the benefit of these other countries, not Israel, for a time. So they could have been very angry with the U.S. at that point, but they're also so dependent on the U.S. that what can they do? So what ends up happening, Nixon resigns and, you know, Lansky is back in the U.S. He doesn't get prosecuted. The oil situation is there to help shore up the dollar. But there's the water, because Watergate had so many leaks and because there were still political conflicts, you get the Intelligence Committee investigations in the 70s, and the Church Committee and the Pike Committee. And I believe that some of what happens there is that they wanted to expose things the CIA was doing in order to get leverage over the CIA. I think that happens in 1967 also, right before the war, because these more Standard Oil friendly, you know, oil man friendly elements of the CIA were not really as close to Israel. They were sort of anti-Israel. They were Arabists, and they could get jobs in Aramco later in life. So they needed to damage the CIA in 1967. So you had these exposés like the Ramparts article on the Student Association, you know, for example. You had the Rosselli story about JFK and the CIA working with the mob. That comes out in the spring of 67. You also had Jim Garrison's investigation, which was undertaken at the behest of Russell Long, Louisiana senator, who was one of the most Teamster corrupted, you know, close to the syndicate figures in the U.S. Senate, very powerful person. But so there's this sort of blackmail going on, and they're all during this time. And Nixon is removed for what he tried to do to the syndicate, which was indirectly doing something to Israel. You have all these investigations and leaks in the years after, and you have the House Select Committee on Assassinations as well. And it's so bizarre because one of the people behind getting the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the 1976 investigation into the JFK assassination and some other assassinations of the 60s, the main person behind this was a guy who was also James McCord's lawyer. When James McCord wanted to go after Nixon in 1972, this guy, his name always is hard for me to remember for some reason, but he's a former Office of Naval Intelligence, Bernard Finsterwald, that's what it was, that's his name. And he was James McCord's lawyer once McCord decided that they really wanted to try to take down Nixon. But he's a guy who in the past was connected to Teamster corruption and had been in the Office of Naval Intelligence, you know, and why is he representing James McCord? But he's also really interested in the Kennedy assassination. And I think it's partly to get leverage over the U.S. for perhaps for Israel or perhaps for the syndicate or both. And so you have these investigations in the 70s, and they play out, and there's a sort of more right-wing establishment in the U.S. at the end of this. Like however these negotiations are done behind the scenes, or however it plays out, the JFK wing of liberal reformism, you know, that's more for peace, that is gone from the political spectrum after Watergate and after the 70s. And also the more nationalistic Richard Nixon side of things was badly weakened. You had people more conservative after that. You have the Reagan Revolution. However, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush became to be more critical of Israel and saw it as a detriment to the U.S. in certain ways.
So the Emir of Bahrain told me one time that George H.W. Bush was the last U.S. president to give the Arabs a fair shake. Those were his exact words.
Yeah.
And every other president was designed.
Well, James Baker, in May of 1989, so a couple months into his presidency, he went to AIPAC and he said, it is time to put aside once and for all the unrealistic vision of greater Israel. Okay? He's getting right to the heart of it. People say, they always say this and that, but this is actually very serious. And Bush forced the Israelis into negotiations with the Palestinians and was going to withhold loan guarantees if they didn't do it. And so they did, but they really resented this. And I believe that they affected the defeat of George H.W. Bush. I believe that Ross Perot was likely some sort of asset or was manipulated to do this. I suspected this before, and then a couple of years ago, I found that there was a company essentially stealing Kurdish, you know, Iraqi oil and Syrian oil using the Kurds, and then taking that oil, shipping that oil through Turkey and then to Israel. And that company was run by Ross Perot Jr., which was such a shock to me. But then I was like, well, that's about what I thought. But additionally, under Bush, you have this BCCI investigation. And the person behind that was Robert Morgenthau, okay? And his family is a huge Zionist family. Like his father, I believe it's his father, was the person who wanted, who was the Treasury Secretary for FDR. Roosevelt. And yes. He also was one of the main people behind the Israeli acquisition of the bomb.
Wow. He's also
and
the
so
man
this guy's going after BCCI. Say that again.
Yeah, he's also the man who coined the term genocide. It wasn't a word until one night he was on a British ship in the port of Izmir watching the Turks massacre the Greeks and the Armenians. And he came up with the word genocide. The murder of a people.
Yeah, I think I vaguely heard that part, but I didn't. When I heard that years ago, maybe I read Samantha Power's book or something like that. But I didn't trace it back to that. So that's wild. So this family is a very Zionist family, and they're going after with a pedigree like this, and they're going after BCCI. And I think it's to expose Bush and to make them afraid that there's going to be more exposure of U.S. secrets. There's also people feeding Danny Casolaro information at this time that traces back to these elements. Even the Iran-Contra scandal may have been related to this, because it's in the mid-80s. There's this scandal with John Tower and the Promise Software, Los Alamos. It involves Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell.
Mm-hmm. An Israeli agent.
They essentially sold, booby-trapped or backdoor Promise Software to Los Alamos, which would give the Israelis access to U.S. nuclear secrets. And this I believe was a scandal, and it may have really it probably outraged the more pro-American people in the U.S. establishment. And they around this time, Iran-Contra becomes this huge scandal. And it's so strange when you think about it. Why was Congress so invested in looking into this? They just don't. These are things that go on all the time, and for some reason they're just against CIA law breaking all of a sudden. And what political interest would have been behind this? And also, some of the stories that come out are, one of the big ones is Lebanon, It comes from a Lebanon newspaper, and that's pretty, that does, it's not hard to imagine why that could, how that could trace back to Israel. Peter Dale Scott, who's really the expert on these things, suspects this, that it was, that Israel was behind that part of it. So these are scandals. These, I think that these scandals of the late 80s, you know, Iran-Contra and the investigations into it and the BCCI scandal, I think that it's likely that this was really the political warfare. It was like another sort of mini Watergate of leaks and scandals. And it was done in order to keep the U.S. and on the side of Israel and the idea of greater and not doing anything that would end the chances for greater Israel. And I think that they're able to defeat George H.W. Bush. And under Clinton, you have a reversal of those kinds of policies. There's just a number of things that come out in that era, that the late Reagan years and George H.W. Bush's presidency. There's like a BBC documentary on Gladio, for example. There's a sexual blackmail ring with Craig Spence and the Franklin scandal that gets exposed at this time and threatens to become a big story. There was even a Discovery Channel documentary made on it that never aired, but still, it would have been shocking if it did. And why would a corporate entity like that do a documentary on these kind of scandals? They just don't go there typically. You even had Oliver Stone's JFK, which I think is a great and important film, but it was financed that when the executive producer was a Israeli agent, Arnon Milchan, who was one of the key people responsible, or he was one of the key people behind the getting the bomb for Israel as well, you know, along with Morgenthau and other prominent Zionists. So there's a story there that just hasn't been covered in detail, but it's like another kind of Watergate. And I think that the outcome is that George H.W. Bush does not get a second term, even though he won the Cold War by getting the Soviet Union to dissolve, and he won the Gulf War against Saddam Hussein. You would expect he would have been, by historical comparisons, he should have been a shoo-in for a second term, and yet he wasn't. And you get a reversal on some of these policies, like NATO expansion, which Bush was against, and also using jihadi operations all around Central Asia, the Middle East and the Balkans. These are reversals. And I think what happened was the sort of super Zionist neoconservative elements got rid of the more rational imperialism of somebody like George H.W. Bush.
Is there any way, do you think, to bring the deep state under some sort of a control, or is it such an important and well-developed state within a state that, despite the rhetoric from Donald Trump about reigning in the deep state and draining the swamp and expelling the swamp creatures, it's just too late?
I think that they have to be either defeated decisively, militarily and economically, which is we're on the brink of seeing that, or it has to be so clear that that's going to happen that some rational actors will intervene. I think that disclosures of some of the crimes of the deep state would be very beneficial for U.S. democracy, and even for the people who, the oligarchs in the U.S. that want to continue to have a functional society, over which they're going to have a lot of, you know, power and prestige. I think that the game is kind of up. This way of doing business, the U.S. is not able to even compete anymore unless we can kill our competition. Like, this is, and this is what we've tried to do. It's like we take it as a truism that, oh, capitalism is just the best system. Look at all the other systems. But then if you look deeper, you see that, well, all these other systems that people have tried to attempt, they had the most powerful countries in the world putting all of the unlimited resources essentially into destroying them. So how do we, if it's really the best system, I mean, look at it. Its monument is all around us. And this is a quite sick society in serious decline in every measurable way, pretty much. And so I think they've lost. They're going to go the way of all empires. And then at that point, the question is, do you want to keep this big surveillance apparatus and have this dysfunctional society when there's not even a global empire anymore? I mean, I just feel the rational thing to do, the sensible thing to do, is going to be kind of undeniable. It's either going to be nuclear war or you're going to reform.
Well, let me ask you about that, Aaron. My own personal view is that the United States is on the backside of its empire. I think that we have overused sanctions as a weapon to the point where we've made sanctions irrelevant. I have a close friend who goes to Iran regularly and who tells me that the Iranians lack for literally nothing. Everything they want and need, they can get from China, India, or Russia, or they can manufacture themselves. They want for nothing. With the advent of BRICS and preliminary conversations about a unified BRICS currency, that could spell the end of dollar dominance in the oil industry, for example. So then what happens to the deep state? I can't imagine a scenario where it just dies quietly as the American empire ends. I can see certainly the deep state going out with a terrible, terrible bang. What's your view of this? Are we at the end of the empire, or are we approaching the end of the empire? And if so, what does that mean for the deep state?
I believe we are approaching the end of the empire. And what it means for the deep state is that the deep state needs to be brought into the light. I think that the democratizing the U.S. and making it transparent is actually in the interest of these people, but will they ever accept it? And that is the big question. I would hope that there are some disclosures coming. Maybe things like Tucker Carlson's 9/11 documentary are a good sign that we're going to be headed in that kind of a direction, and that they're trying to roll it out in weird ways. I don't know. This is the strangest time to be alive.
Aaron, tell us about the making of your book into a documentary series.
We started filming in the spring of 2023, and it was difficult for me because my younger sister had just died of an overdose, and it was really a difficult time. But we'd rented this place and hired a cinematographer, a videographer, and so we set about recording a bunch of interviews where I went over different parts of my dissertation, which became the book American Exception: Empire and the Deep State. And the person making it his name is Scott Noble, and he's made a bunch of films on YouTube with really low budget, but with good results. He used stock footage and different kinds of narration. He interviewed people to make these very good documentaries on subjects pertaining to U.S. imperialism, like Psy War is one of them. The Power Principle is a documentary series. And we had a little bit of help from some other individuals who would provide, you know, technical expertise, you know, graphical. They could do graphics or sound. We had a lot of people chip in. And it tells the story of the U.S. empire and the U.S. deep state in a way that's more critical than any other documentary that I know of. I think you could compare it a little bit to Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States. But we go in more specifically into the deep state itself. Now, some of the things that I was talking about today, especially how Zionism came to be the driving force behind neoconservatism, that's not covered as much in the film because it's not in the book. It's only something that really came into focus for me under the Gaza genocide. It made me, and conversations that I'd had with Peter Dale Scott, where I came to discover that he had left a lot of this information out. In his suspicions about an Israeli role in a lot of these things. So the film is, I think, the explanation that I put out about the deep state is the best explanation that I can come up with for the way the U.S. government actually functions, not as a democracy, but as a lawless regime bent on global dominance and pursuing it in a lawless way and in a way that's not really explained to the American public. So I'm hoping that this film is going to be coming where we need to find distribution for it. And that's a challenge. But I'm hoping that it strikes a chord with people because we need a bigger and deeper, more the insightful explanation as to why we got to this point. And that was what I tried to do with my dissertation. And that's what the film attempts to do. It attempts to explain the deep state in a serious and scholarly way, not like a sort of tabloid conspiracy mongering sort of way. It attempts to connect it to the history of the U.S. and to capitalism as a system in general. And I think capitalism really can't, it's never really been totally a lawful thing. It's always had this sort of dark force propelling it at the top, which is just the pursuit of more money and more power. And we built a civilization around the pursuit of money and power. And I think that there are better ways to organize society. And I think that we're going to have to do that. I hope that the film can help people better understand the system that we have, because that is a prerequisite to changing things in any sort of serious way. So I'm really excited for people to be able to see the film. And I'm hoping that we're able to find a distribution deal for it soon.
Oh, I hope so, too. Listen, just knowing you, not having seen the film, of course, but just knowing you, I know how important this film is going to be. So just to remind people, it's called American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. It's based on the book that is your PhD dissertation. I read the book two, three years ago.
I think the film is just American Exception.
Oh, it's just American Exception? Good enough. Good enough. It's going to be outstanding. Good luck with
the
distribution. Yep. Yep, definitely. Well, Dr. Aaron Good, thanks again for joining us.
And
folks, would you do me a personal favor and hit that subscribe button? It's only because of people like you that we can keep these things going. It means a lot to me. Thanks very much. And Aaron, all the best.
Yep. Thank you very much, John.